working. I was out on vacation for much of the last week. Yeah. Well, I flew out to my parents in the States.
Oh, I see. Were you from the States?
Well, I was born in Calgary and moved to the States. So.
Where?
Well, currently my parents live in the Chicago area.
If we end up with extra time, we can look at the setup last week. So the shock solution. This is known as the solid shock tube solution. It's what if you ever write a computer program to simulate tube fluids. One of the first tests that anyone ever does is make sure that you can recover all these relations if anywhere as you drive analytically. Because it's just one of the main equations of fluid mechanics are horribly complicated. So the fact that you can find any solution for them at all is a minor error.
So yeah, as Mark said, we're looking at shock waves. Basically, we're looking at a case
specifically where there's a supersonic flow, and then it encounters some sort of disturbance, and the flow becomes subsonic. And then we're trying to basically derive the equations that govern the dynamics of this shock wave, which is the discontinuity between the two regions. So the first question asks us to determine the ratios of pressure, rho, or density, velocity, and temperature between the two regions. So to do this, we're going to use the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy between the two regions, the flux of them, basically. So we have this. And then there's, I didn't know how to draw this necessarily, but there's some sort of object here. And then the flow gets altered.
It's not a physical object.
It's just.
I mean, it's literally a way. It's a location in the fluid where things are just spontaneous.
I have a way to draw that maybe a bit clearer.
Sure, yeah.
Well, just imagining the physical case of something traveling through, we have the velocity going down, and then we have some object here which is going supersonically relative. Oh, so then we get a conical shockwave coming off of this, and then meets the shock, which is where the influence of the object first be felt, and then does something here.
So yeah, that's a realistic case. But if you have a one-dimensional,
it's one-dimensional.
So it's just sort of like if you
yeah,
isolated
if you isolate
a very tiny region of that and just and try to study exactly what changes like in a little tiny box along that shock front.
So like right.
And so this really happens. Yeah. I mean, you've seen pictures of. I mean, this is the real world. Shocks are around us all the time. All the time
there was
this supersonic
motion. So we have, I'll just put it on here. We have this with pressure one. Yeah, thank you. And then, of course, in here. And this is the discontinuity, and we'll say it's at x equals 0. Just imagine, and like I said, we're going to conserve mass, energy, and momentum across the two regions. So for
can you think of a way of rephrasing x equals zero to describe along? Remember the R characteristic variable.
The characteristic variables of the problem.
For sound, remember we did it for sound letters, but it's just generally speaking, you can write down very positive.
Okay.
Was that,
are we talking about just x naught plus vt? Okay. Where? What? Okay. So for conservation of mass, you can say that the mass coming out of this region is the mass coming into this region. So it's mass flux conservation. So you just say like dm is equal to dmt. And then the mass coming out of one is just going to be the density times the velocity times the area. Similarly for two. But the area over which it's going through is the same. So these cancel. You just get this equation. And that's our mass flux equation. And then it gets a little more complicated for energy and momentum, but I'll go through it. So for energy conservation, we'll just start with the ideal gas law. Kind of a long derivation. We know that the enthalpy of an ideal gas is given by where this is like the internal energy of the gas, and this is like, so I wasn't sure exactly how to think of this, but this is like a spring energy almost, I think, because it's like the pressure over the density. Yeah, okay. I was trying to figure out what it was. Okay. And the internal energy is just the specific heat for an ideal gas times speed. Which is this. Again, for an ideal gas. Gamma is defined by this. Yeah, for a polytropic fluid. So this is just equal to gamma 1 minus 1. Okay, so maybe I should take for adiabatic flows, we'll get this relation. And this comes from this. The change in enthalpy is given by TdS plus this. But for adiabatic flows, TdS is zero. Oh wait, is this right? Let's go to that. Now we can use Bernoulli's principle with this knowledge, armed with this knowledge, where you have this. So now we can sub in enthalpy here, and then we just pull it from here. And we'll get our energy conservation between the two regions. And we'll just get E1 squared plus E1 And then the potentials are the same between the two. So they cancel. And that's our energy conservation. Now for momentum conservation, so schematically I'm going to look at the structure of the continuity equation, and it has this type of structure. It's like density. Of its flux. So this is zero. So this is structurally what continuity equation says. So to get the conservation of momentum flux between the two regions, I'm gonna try to sort of have like a momentum density here, and I'm gonna get an equation for the momentum flux, and then that will be conserved between the two regions. So to do this, we can start with the continuity equation. We'll just write it out. Multiply by dk. And I and j are running from 1, 2, 3, not 0. So it's on camera, right? And then we'll use Euler's equation and sub that, and we'll add the two because they'll have similar terms. So Euler's equation is this. But we'll assume that the external force is zero. And we're just multiplying by density here. Okay, so what did I do here? I'm trying to skip a step, but I multiplied by, oh no, okay, so yeah. So, okay, I'll just write. So yeah, this is just this, right? And then I'm going to add the two.
That's where that ambiguous row looking thing is actually.
What's that?
The last letter you just wrote.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's. So.
It's some cruel fate that Fisher and Rowe would pull off on the board.
So actually, a lot of the problems, actually later on in the discussion, when you're trying to combine these three equations and get ratios, a lot of the mistakes I made were just, you know, pressure and row in my own writing.
It's okay, it's called pressure. Like,
yeah,
Q,
I know. So if we add these two together, we'll get Bj Bdt. And then we can combine this as, and we get our momentum density.
Wait, where are the last equation?
I'm adding the Euler and the continuity equation in those two forms.
You said that.
And then this is the derivative as well. So we have our momentum density, like we were trying to do. And then this will be its flux. So we can combine this. We can define like a momentum flux tensor, or momentum flux tensor as this. And this is what's going to be conserved between the two regions from this picture. So I'll just write that out. So we'll have E1 plus rho 1 E1 squared. So these are our three equations that we're going to use. This one. And then we're asked to find ratios between the variables in these equations. Now this is a little involved too, but I'll go through it. I don't know how in depth I'll go through it, but I'll go through the structure of it at least. So we have to note.
Do we have any questions up to this point?
Yeah, thanks.
Completely clear. Thank you. All those questions myself, I think I follow what's going on.
So, give an option. So, we'll note that the max speed is given by V1 over VS. Oh, it's just VS.
For computing reasons, it's
called CS. Because like, it's like speed of light, but sound. A constant. And we know that CS is defined by this, or maybe it's not defined, but it's given by this.
Yeah, well, you have to calculate that from it's the derivative of pressure with respect to density.
Because it's a polytropic fluid. Yeah. And we'll say this. Because M is only going to come in squared, so we'll say this. Now, we'll solve for the ratio of the densities first. for this, we'll take the energy conservation and we'll isolate for P2. I saw this first. Yeah. So we have six. We have six variables in four equations, and then we have one relation here that we'll just substitute different variables. But so we're going to get an equation which has two of the variables in terms of the other one. But the goal. So the structure of this is we're going to isolate for two of the variables using two of the equations, and sub them into each other, and then isolate for a third one with the third equation and put that into there. And then some of them are we're gonna substitute this, and it's gonna be in terms of just two variables then, because we have six variables and four equations. So this is equal to this. Correct me if I make a mistake here. I'm just copying my notes, basically.
You just solved your energy.
In terms of? Yeah, I just rearranged it in terms of pressure, the second pressure, or the pressure in region two. And we'll put this into the momentum conservation equation. So we'll get. And then we'll use from the mass conservation that V2 squared is equal to 1 squared V2 squared. So we'll get hot in here. I'm getting sweaty. I don't think it's from doing this problem. A little hot in here. It's hot under these lights. So we'll multiply by it.
Wait until you're doing this for a doctor.
Yeah. Probably won't reflect well. You're sweating up a storm. It simplifies things.
Algebra is its own reason.
It's a strong reason in this question. Oh no, wait. I just recopied down. Okay. So I was copying the line above. Which is is another mistake that you might run into. Oh, I almost did it again. I can tell you what's going to happen while I'm writing this down. We're going to get a quadratic equation in row 2 over row 1. And then I'm going to rearrange it into a nice form that you can pick off these solutions. And one of the solutions is going to be the case where there's no discontinuity. It's just row 2 is equal to row 1. And the other case is going to be the case we're interested in. This is just the, what did I do? Okay. So I multiplied by row 2 over row 1. And then I substituted the definition of M1 using this. M1 squared. Is that what I did? Yes. And then I pulled out this factor. And then I combined it for this. Yeah.
You just isolated. You're just picking terms.
Picking terms. I'm really sweating up here. No, that's okay. I think it's, I have too much hair. So yeah, and then you just divide through by this thing, which is equal to.
Where do you just solve that quadratic equation?
With the quadratic equation. So I did a. So actually, I rearranged it into a nice form, and you can just pick up solutions. So I'll go that way because it looks nice. So I multiplied through by 2 gamma m squared. It's probably obvious by now, but I'll just say it. And then you divide by this term. So we're going to pull out a negative here and just put it up on the denominator. And then rearrange this to a form which we can divide some of that term. And we'll take out a negative here as well, and then we'll cancel this one. And then rearrange these, I think. No, just factor these. So these two cancel. I pulled out a negative from this denominator, and it canceled with this.
So that one's supposed to be equal to 0?
This is equal to 0?
The line above is supposed to be equal to 0.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yes.
I thought that was an equal sign in the
middle. Oh, no. Yeah. These are two separate lines. So these two terms cancel, and then you just left this over this. And so this term is the same as this term, and we'll call it lambda. And you get an equation of this form, basically. You get x squared minus 1 plus lambda plus lambda is equal to 0. Okay. And this has solutions x equals 1. Equals lambda. And like I said, the one case where x equals 1 is the ratio is equal to 1. So this is, there's no discontinuity. And then this is the case we're interested in. So we have, as our final ratio, and then from mass conservation, the ratio of velocities is just the inverse of this. And then for pressure, I'm not going to go through it, but you do a similar type of thing. What's that?
Yeah.
You isolate for the densities instead of the pressures, and then you put them in. And then it also asks for the ratio of temperatures. And then the ratio of temperatures is given by, so recall we had this definition. We use the ideal gas law. So this is just equal to this. And then you have your temperature when you just, if you have the ratio of the pressure and the ratio of the density, you just plug it in. So that's part A. I'll go through part B too.
Part B, that's a pretty straightforward extension.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as is usually the case with Pat Nanamon, he just says something in like two lines. But to actually show that, it takes a little bit more work, I think. So for this one, if m is greater than 1, is it? It's obvious. Yeah, I mean, yeah. But for the temperature case, it's a little subtle, I think.
The thing is to take the
So okay, yeah, the density case is easy, velocity case is easy because it's just the inverse. The pressure case isn't that bad either. So maybe I'll write down the equations for these ratios.
Density and velocity ratios mixed up, or having rho 2 over rho 1 equal v1.
Yeah, there's a typo in the book where for the velocities he exchanges the numbers, the subscripts. But I mean, if you have mass conservation, it's obvious that there's. So. It's in the solutions to 310A.
Oh, I see. I think this has rho 2 over rho 1 equals 3 over 1.
So yeah, for the pressure case, it's obvious too. If you have M1 greater than 1, this whole ratio is greater than 1. So pressure 2 is greater than pressure 1. But
yeah, I guess the temperature case is a little low.
So I'll just write down. So I'll try to skip some steps because I put my temperature ratio in a weird form, and it's easier to see how this works out in a different form. So. So from here, I tried to massage this into a way that I could see, compare it to this. I don't know if you want me to go through this. So you can massage this into this form, so it's equal to this. Plus this term. So if this term is greater than 1, then this ratio is obviously greater than 1. But this isn't necessarily the case because of this factor up front. And I wasn't sure about the definition, so I emailed Mark. He said that there's no real constraints on gamma. There's a constraint from the speed of sound equation has to be greater than 0, or else speed of sound is negative, or imaginary, sorry. But this can range from 0 to 1. But zero to whatever, yeah, but it can be in this region where this term is actually negative and this ratio will be smaller. But I think for most physical cases, gamma is greater than 1, so we can approximate this.
This would be, I mean, if you think about it, the gamma being less than 1 corresponds to the pressure. I mean, so
the density being bigger than the.
I mean, yeah, changes in the density corresponding to the smaller. In fact, I don't know if there's any actual physical cases for that. I don't think so. I expect there. I expect there. They're just.
Okay.
Going to the issue of CP or MC.
Sorry.
And what is the ratio of CP and MC? It will be a case where from the negative high pressure the density is and if the ratio is less than
5.
I think it will be the
case. So you're saying that gamma is given by the ratio of
CP or CP.
units be a constant pressure gradient? Or ideally, yes, we have CP is equal to CV plus R.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think, I think if gamma is less than 1, it actually violates some one laws of thermodynamics or something. Something weird that makes it possible to make an ideally efficient or more than 100% efficient
Carnot engine
process. Or, yeah.
Okay. So we'll say this term is greater than. We don't want to ruin any physical process. We don't want to violate
the. So, this is one of the things like that. Don't really think about physical gas. There are cases in crazy theories of cosmology where all of these sorts of things are not. Yeah, but doesn't mean they actually happen.
Oh, and the second part of B asks to show that the maximum possible density, you can increase it by a factor of.
It's over there, it's just a limit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So to see this, you can put this into. You can put it in this form. Just dividing by m 1 squared. And the only thing we're allowed to increase is m 1 squared, so we neglect this term and just equal to this, which is what we're asked to show. Now part C. Ratios would be negative, so you have some sort of negative density.
Yeah. What happens if gamma happens to stay exactly equal to 1? So that's, I mean, that's almost an almost that would be almost infinite. So, but the point is though that you can take the terms around if you have. Very large density jump, what does that mean about the flow?
Yeah, I think again, it's close to 1.
If you observe a very large density and you want to infer something about the flow of the fluid that's going into the shell, what can you do? I'm just trying to get around. Which of those numbers do we make big to make that big?
It's traveling very fast.
Very strong.
Now, I'm trying to think of what this says about this approximation. Like, can you make this really, really big if gamma is less than 1, which is why this might break.
Oh, no, if gamma is less than 1.
It'd just be really hard.
If gamma is less than 1, that becomes negative.
Yeah, but I mean, this term is going to become big. Because, well, I think that it'll be really hard to make the speed of sound fast. Or sorry, the velocity in the region very fast if gamma is. So M1 is equal to
P1 squared.
Oh, right here.
Yeah,
P1. Oh, no, gamma is. It doesn't think. Never mind. Thought that maybe. Okay, so gamma is greater than 1, we'll say. Are there any more comments?
So for say, like in a you remember what gamma is for, like a whiteboard?
It's like 4 over 3.
So what would that
5 over 3. 5 or four. So, no, sorry, sorry. Yeah. So 4 over 3 is 7 over 3. For there.
So that's
a shockwave in a white dwarf is going to have this density change.
A very strong shock.
That's pretty cool.
It's supported by the generous density
gradient. Okay. That's cool. Oh, yeah. Get your hands dirty in this question.
Can you think of a case where something like a white dwarf might have a shockwave passing through it?
If it was close to a supernova or something, there was a supernova.
So this would become, it's not spherically symmetric, right? So different. It would be, in fact, the set-up solution, which we're going to talk about later, probably since we aren't going to be able to do all the compensations.
Okay.
So this has to do with. There's an open question of whether supernovae are conflagrations or deflagrations. And the question has to do with whether the burning happens supersonically.
Faster. Yeah.
So these sorts of considerations.
Now, they don't burn fast enough, but they burn faster than one case. So it's like a combination of the two. I was reading something about that. So deflagration is. Deflagration, I think there's fragments or like stuff ejected from it, so it's not a complete burn. So they burn slower than that. Yeah, because that's the fast case, right? Where it's very chaotic. So I was reading something and it said that it burns slower than like what you would expect it to be if it was completely deflagration. But it burns faster than, you know, a complete burn. So it has to be some sort of mix of the two. Maybe there's more than one phase to the burn or something like that. But yeah, open question.
Okay, so yes, you did part C.
I did part C.
A and B. And so does somebody else want to do C?
Okay. Yeah.
Anybody else do C? You didn't do it,
right? I didn't, but. Didn't fully understand all the logic behind it.
Okay. Well, do you wanna go through
it? I'll go through what we have to talk about it.
You have it pretty. You've done problems. Plenty of problems.
So we're supposed to show in part C that the discontinuity for physical. So in this case, we're assuming ideal fluid. So for a realistic case, we're supposed to show that the discontinuity occurs over the region over a thickness which is of the same order as the mean free path. And to show this, we have to take into account the dissipative forces or the dissipative effects. If we look at the conservation of momentum equation. It will become of this form. Where I'm saying that the dissipative effects are in this. P. Or, I don't know. Yeah, we derive the form of that. Now, for the one for our one-dimensional case, so this is going to be a tensor, right? It's going to be of this form. That's all, right? But for our one-dimensional case, we're only gonna take this component. So we have this.
Okay.
So this part of my derivation, I don't really understand. I took an equation from Pat Nanabon from a previous problem where he defines, or he doesn't define, but he says that this is true. Okay. It's from equation 3.67. If you want to look it up in the solution side.
We derived it?
Yeah. Must have been asleep. So this is the macroscopic flow of the fluid, and this is the microscopic flow. And so I made the approximation that this is approximately equal to the change of the microscopic. I'm trying to think of why I did this.
Well,
so near the discontinuity, the change is going to be dominating the macroscopic flow.
Well, the way I think of it is that in cases, the microscopic flow is like the chaos due to just the temperature, right? And you know that's on the order of a few times the speed of sound, the flow. And the case we have is where we've got a change of macroscopic flow on the order of the speed of sound. So
it's going to be. So we can make this part, as Brian is saying, right? So if we do that, and then we'll divide by this thing everywhere, we'll get this. And it's just like I divided by over here.
Maybe you should write that explicitly. Sigma X.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So then we can put that into here. But so Pat Nanabon says that in the shock layer that this is either the so this is the thermal state of effect and this is the state of effect. Now he says that in shock layer, these are going to be of the same order, or this. I wasn't exactly sure.
He's just asserting.
Okay.
So. Well, why do we know that?
Yeah, that's. But.
Just from any case, if you just. I mean, the point is that viscosity will always be present, whereas thermal effects are sometimes present. Sometimes important, sometimes not. It's just this is these supervening information about fluids that you just have to assume without proof as far as within the scope of this course.
Okay.
I think you could probably cook up. You could probably. I'm not exactly sure. I think the point is that viscosity is always around.
Does the thermal effects lead into viscous effects?
They're distinct, right? These are
like the more chaotic the fluid, the more viscous it is, maybe. Because this is going to change the flow, right? Move.
So, I mean, that, you don't need to write that.
Okay. So if we say that it's either approximately equal to this or much less than this. Either way, like this equation is going to be, you know.
Generally speaking, I mean, it's a little silly that we're going to be maybe keep the design term around. And you can usually just take the.
Either way, to like, this is going to be approximate correct for that order. Now, for rapid change in physical parameters, because we have this small thickness of a shock layer, which is going to change, you know, the density, the pressure, all that stuff, very fast, small range. This is going to be of the same order as these two terms for this to occur. This is apparently more more important. That's what he said.
The point is that if they're all of the same order, you can just isolate.
Okay. So,
the point is that there's no reason to think that the one is bigger than the other, or that it's a, just start with the assumption that each term is roughly of the same order, in which case you can equate any adopted factors of the order. Since this is explicitly sort of an approximation. Approximation problems are always up to orders, factors of order.
So up to factors of order unity will equate these.
Right. And does everyone see why this should be true and why this dissipation effect should be of order the other effects during it in within the shock? Does everyone understand? Does anyone? Can anyone give a reason for that? Not Nathan. So in the space of the shock, what's happening to its pressure? Changing rapidly. How do we know it's changing rapidly? This is I'm looking for simple answers.
Well, because it has to change the ratio of 7 or whatever x so we could jump up and small space to do it and it changes rapidly.
Bingo. So if it's changing rapidly, so do these fluid equations without dissipation allow that? The answer is no. So the point is though that if it's changing rapidly, the change in the pressure is order of the pressure, right? And that's what rapid change means. The changes are going to be multiples of the value, not 10%, but like 6. Like, you know, like the pressure, the new pressure in terms of the old pressure is like 6 times, if not some tiny 0.01%. Right? This is the point. This is an actual discontinuity. And so to have an actual discontinuity set up in a sort of space, I mean, gradients are not small gradients that are just as big as all of the fluid. Not right. So that's what's going on. Does that make sense? So we usually can ignore this because the changes are small. Changes delta V over delta X is like V is constant, it's 0, right? And so what happens in a strange way, in these little tiny
Well, one question this raises is, if these effects are relevant, then wouldn't we have to account for those in, you know, taking all the other equations we did in part A?
So we assumed an ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We also assumed that the first part that is, we assume that this process is ideal, right?
Yeah, the fluid is generally except for the somewhat the miracle of this sort of study of Schadler is that it's okay to do that. You can assume the ideal fluid is perfectly adiabatic, and you still find the existence of shock currents, which tells you that encoded in the equations is evidence of their breakdown, right? Because you can't do this. You know that to have this matching happen, you have supersonic flow and it changes rapidly. And you know that you can observe that it changes rapidly to subsonic flow, which is what a shock current is, right? Then can't do that without some funny way. And so that tells you that there aren't any, there can't be this. So if you have an absolutely perfect flow, it's everywhere perfect, then this isn't happening. No. And so once you've asserted that this happens, you can describe everything about, it turns out you can describe both sides of the shock without ever learning anything real about, like, the messy details of real fluids. But if you want to actually look at that little tiny space in between where it's not smooth flow, not smooth pre-shock flow or smooth post-shock flow, then you're going to have to know something about the fluid that's shocking. What's kind of amazing about fluid mechanics is that you can do that. And it's not only nice for a classroom, but it's okay in the real world. I mean, it's relatively okay in the real world. But real flows are pretty ideal, and then they hit shocks where everything goes to hell. And then afterwards, they're okay again. And it's okay on both sides to describe them in this really ideal way. And it's actually a pretty good approach. Sort of, it's one of those things. Anyway, does that make sense? Does that make a little bit more sense?
Well, does that come from the fact that, you know, momentum, energy, and mass?
Yeah, exactly. It's just because these equations are, you know, there's nothing crazy about them. They're not, it's just mass. It's as much mass going in as well. So it's just only if you want sort of fine scale details that these aren't equations.
Okay, so we're also going to assume that during this small region, that this change, like this delta x, during this delta x, the change is constant. So the change in velocity. So we'll make this approximation, and we'll note that nu.
I would use nothing other than nu. I think nu is incredibly important.
Okay.
No.
Like a pi or something. Equal to this. So we'll get this. And again, for this region, the change in velocity is approximately equal to the velocity. Or are we saying that? Yeah. It's of the order velocity. So we'll just do this. And then, again, another point where I didn't understand Pat Anamon, but he says that this is approximately equal to LV.
That was
I think that's just a way of defining viscosity.
Yeah.
Okay. Me, Mina, and Farbad were trying to like find physical reasons for this. Yeah, and we couldn't.
I mean, isn't that like this is something like that for like the viscosity estimates?
In problem set 4, like the first question, yeah, something. I mean, there were a lot more variables, like mass and other stuff, temperature, stuff like that. But we were trying to figure this out, and we were really confused.
You can do it dimensionally, right?
We were trying to do it dimensionally. And this thing has, like, you know, dimensions, meters squared over seconds squared. We didn't really know what that was. Yeah, because this is meters per second. Oh, sorry. Meters squared per second. Yeah. But, I mean, if we use this, it's you just plug it in here, and the thickness is approximately equal to the mean free path. Is there, do you have a physical argument for this?
Well, so the point is just that for this cost, I mean, it's okay just to say that viscosity is going to be governed by this, whether it's the mean free path or not. So the point is that as the mean free path increases, the viscosity increases. So, because that means there's less time between. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't know why he's fixated on this being feedback. That's true, but I mean, the point though is that the viscosity is basically equal to the viscosity is proportional to the fluid. So the more viscous the fluid, the broader.
Yeah. The less ideal it is, the bigger the thickness of the shock is going to be.
So that, I mean, I don't, so that's why I thought it was kind of funny that you focused on, I guess that's what he was thinking. But.
Yeah, well, the way I looked at that and what he was implying is mean free path is, you know, how far the particle travels before it has one interaction on average. So what it's saying is it has an order of one interaction within the shock before it transfers over into the area beyond.
Right. That makes sense. It needs at least one. Yeah. One shocking collision to go from one to the other.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I guess it obviously needs at least one, but this also tells us that it doesn't take many, many, just a few.
So, but yeah, to my mind, the more important thing is just this the relationship between
viscosity.
And so, speaking again, to go back to how this is actually used, whenever you actually solve equation to solve like numerically fluid equations, you always have to introduce if you want to capture shocks. Like it's very hard to do numerical simulations of fully viscous fluids. And so what you do actually is you introduce spurious viscosity for numerical problems of exactly this form. So that you can spread out shocks. Because in an ideal fluid, shocks, there is no shock. The lift of shocks is literally zero.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't describe this kind of phenomenon within ideal gases. Right? And so shock waves are literally just discontinuities in space. I think it's just true. Obviously, those never ever really happen. Neither can computers handle absolute discontinuities. And so by adding some viscosity, you can spread this out so that you can make shock waves discernible by finite. It happens in the real world and in the new world. Right,
okay. So the last part? Part D, I didn't end up finishing, but I thought a bit about. I had some conceptual issues with, and maybe you guys can help me out here. So we have this semi-infinite cylindrical tube, and there's a piston moving at one side. And then Panarmon says that the shock wave is going to be moving faster than the piston after some time. And I couldn't...
From the beginning, when the piston starts to move, there will be, first of all, a physical limit at the speed of sound that you can possibly get any information to. And so that's how I originally tried to do things, but apparently that's not right, just assuming a shock at the speed of sound, which is... where the impact of the piston starting to move will be felt.
But. So I forgot that I resolved this issue last time, actually. I was thinking. So I had an issue with, you have this disruption, this piston's causing this disruption, and then, so this piston's traveling at a constant velocity, u. and it causes a disruption, and then the disruption end up traveling faster than this U. And I couldn't understand that. And then I was talking to Brandon, and this piston is continuously putting energy into this fluid. So it's gonna push the velocity.
More of the gas is moving faster now.
So one way to think about it is like a snowball.
Yeah, yeah. There's more gas being added to it constantly because it's building up. Right. Yeah. Okay.
You better like this. One of the punchlines is just that, like, if you just think about conservation of mass, like the tube is getting shorter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
So it's traveling. The front is traveling at the same speed, but. In the frame of the tube, because the tube is getting smaller, the tube is moving to it in a sense.
So okay. it's like a scoop, right? You're scooping up more and more gas. So there has to be some part of the gas that's getting thicker.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
So then the fluid equations tell you how to propagate that through pressure.
So I think if you have that assumption, then the rest of the solution follows.
It's basically just like
you're just doing part of it. But I had some, I couldn't see why. I mean, it makes sense now. But.
Yeah, it's a conceptual point, which is why we're doing it. Does that make sense to you? Why you could just start with a, just like have a tube and you start pushing on it, and the affected fluid, amount of fluid is going to be increasing in time. Does that make sense? No,
you guys should say yes. Okay, so that's shock waves.
Okay, so I just want to talk a little bit about problem. I guess I'll talk about it about 314, just because it has a nice connection to this. Yeah. Nice story associated with it, which is so the other time you can solve exactly the equations for I'm not going to go through the full solution either because it's a bear. The thing that made this feasible, right, was that it was in one dimension. So there's the other case of one-dimensional fluid flow, and that's if you have a spherical flow, right? So basically, I'm just showing the surface, right? But if you have an infinite fluid, all at constant energy, and then you put a whole lot of energy in to that fluid. Anyway, then the point is that the point is that you have an amount of energy E is zero. And it turns out that the energy has units of what? Mass. So kilograms, meters squared, seconds squared, right? And then rho in units of kilograms in units cubed, right? I just use k.
this semi-unit place. And so the point is that so E over rho will have unit. Use the fifth over second square, right? So, okay, so that doesn't look that promising at first. But you realize that, then you start thinking about this problem and you say, well, okay, what happens if I put a lot of energy into a fluid? Well, there's going to be probably this shock front that develops. And so it's going to be some distance that's been traveled at some time, t. And so that's a distance and that's a time. So maybe we should just equate this to that distance to the fifth divided by that time squared, and then just solve for r as a function of t, and that you get e t squared over rho. So the radius of the shock front is proportional to the energy you put in divided by the density of the fluid that's going into to the 1/5 power up to something numerical constant. The existence of this numerical quantity allows you, as it turns out, to solve the equations of motion for this fluid. But historically speaking, that this is important because explosions had never really been studied before, like really powerful explosions were studied for the first time during World War II. And so what people realized was that this would describe the radius of the blast front of a nuclear explosion, or any explosion, but in particular a nuclear explosion. There's two interesting facts for that. One, that if you could watch a video of a blast wave, or a video of a blast wave expanding, if you know when explosion goes off and where it is at any later time, and if you know like the density of air, then you can figure out how powerful the explosion was. Right? You just need two facts. You can also find out what the velocity of a shock front is too, right? This is going to be basically 2/5 e to the 1/5 rho to the 1/5 e to the minus 1/5 2/5. And so then this also tells you that the velocity of a shock front is falling, which you might expect, as it's scooping, because it's going to be scooping that fluid. Does this make sense? Anyway, so the fun part of the story is that, so knowing this fact, and that they needed to know solutions, that in the U.S., what they did was they just put, the Western collaboration, or the Allied collaboration, just started solving these equations on a computer to find the subsequent flow, to find out what the density is a function of radius and the pressure is a function of radius work and stuff like that. But in Russia, they also wanted to know the answer, but they didn't have computers. So they actually Russian physicist figured out that you could solve these equations exactly. It's sort of amazing, but it's a really beautiful little calculation. Get that forward. It turns out that there's an integral you can do that fully solves the equation. And so
this has to be as a number of dimensions.
Exactly. So it's kind of cool. The punchline, which is pictured in Padmanabhan's book, is that if you plot as a function of r over the shock front, the velocity basically rises linearly. That the density is something like that. But so the pressure is the interesting thing. It really spikes. So this is V rho. And so this is why explosions hurt. Because so you're you know, here, and then the blast, this comes to you. And so as a function of time, you have a gradient in pressure that goes, this basically goes like a delta function. And this jump is actually determined by very similar equations like that y'all solved. So the jump in density is going to be something like gamma plus 1 over gamma minus 1. The jump in pressure is some other function that's basically the pressure is what are we right here?
It's going to be like just raised to the power of gamma.
Yeah, exactly.
So is this saying that within some critical radius the pressure is zero?
Basically, yeah, the pressure is approximately zero on the inside.
So if you're within a certain blast radius, you're not going
to be. Well, after it's gone past you, then there's nothing left. There's no pressure in the middle of the bubble. It's just it's all confined into a shell, which is a shock. But anyway, so I think that's an interesting fact. Okay. So does anybody have anything to say about the next problem? You know, you came in late. Do you have anything for problem 410? So maybe we could just, since y'all had trouble with it, can you point out portions that were confusing, and we can talk about that so that you can solve it later.
Well, part A, I thought it was straightforward. Part B, like
okay. Part B is hard.
I kind of ran out of time. Too,
so. Oh.
But, yeah, we're supposed to describe the origin of the terms.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have anything to say about the next problem?
Are we assuming something about is the electron like moving slowly?
Yeah, I think that you can. Well, I think that it's going to be assuming a non-relativistic. Yeah. Yeah, you definitely are going to assume that.
Actually, that's true. In part A, I had to assume that the photon's energy was less than the relativistic energy of the electron. That's your idea.
The photon, so
HU is supposed to be much, much less than PC over C.
That, yeah, I think.
But it was not a relativistic case.
Well, I mean, it's just because it's probably going to be less than that squared, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, so it's just even less than just the convention. So, I think it's just, unless the, I mean, okay, so this is.
Is that true?
What?
Is PC equal to, it's not
going to be. No, it's not going to be, these aren't equal. These aren't equal. I'm just saying that. No. Right, I mean, well, in the relativistic cases when they are the same order.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, for the non-relativistic case,
oh, I see what you're. Oh, I see what you're worried about. So you're just saying this is.
Yeah.
So yeah. So what? How come? So how come you're assuming that doesn't substantially change the kinetic energy? So yeah, that's a good question. Is it just the Compton scattering formula? Is. None of it's valid for all energies. But where did you have to assume this?
If you look at an Erentz solution, he has an equation, and he says that the other terms in the numerator and the denominator are corrections. Yeah, but I mean, this has the same order of there, like in this.
What?
Yeah, I mean, there's two factors in this term that goes to zero, or that is a correction. It's this term, and it has a one minus the dot product between the initial direction of the photon and the final direction.
And not in front.
Yeah, and not in front.
Okay.
Now, maybe that term is very small.
Because if
especially for the non-relatives.
Yes. And if the change in the energy of the photon is very small, then the change in direction will be also very small.
Mm-hmm.
So this n dot n prime will be nearly equal to 1. So 1 minus 1 will be very small.
Hmm? Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. That's just, that's sort of.
Better way is just to say that term is negligible.
Or, yeah, our second order. The change in the direction. Yeah, just assuming that the directional changes is just, you're just, that each individual collision is a small.
And if that directional change is big, this thing is small because it's relatively
small. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm not. If y'all haven't done this problem, I have to think a little bit about what we're going to do this afternoon. So maybe you can. We'll just come back at 12:45. Let's just say 12:45, and I'll talk to the AI. And we'll decide what to do. Because we also need to. He may want to talk to him about whatever problems that he has picked up for y'all. Because I'm going to be away the next. So next week we do not have class. Instead, there's this meeting here. And then, so 2 weeks from now, two, three, and 4 weeks from now, I won't be here. So. Sorry, I'm going to be traveling. So Niyesh will be handling that. So I'll go talk to him and so about what let's do with the rest of this. Do y'all have any other questions first?
Yeah, actually, this expression.
4.42.
Yeah, one plus one. Mm-hmm. I think it should be reversed because this case should be for the case where for all of anything is incident. Because C and U will be doing the flux of the
problem. So did you wonder why that term is that?
I mean there should be a negative slope. I mean, is the rate of elimination of photons frequency be
right? Or yeah, it's either.
Because 1 plus n would be the final step.
Yeah.
It's the boson, so that's why we have plus 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
This term is, in some sense, reducing the number of photons in frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think this should be negative here or here. This is the rate of elimination.
Oh, I see what you're worried about. Yeah, well, I guess. Because this is the creation of new photons of
frequency new prime.
Yeah, that could be. images if you switch these. Yes. I think that could be right. I'm not sure. I have to. I'll double check it. I didn't really use PubMed on solution. Okay. Well, I'll check that, and then. Any other questions?
Okay. I'll see you all in an hour. An hour and a bit.